Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Welcome to the final Peter B. Collins podcast for the calendar year 2009. Over the holidays, we're going to be refurbishing the website at peterbcollins.com to make it even more friendly. And in the new year, we'll announce the launch of a second podcast. It's going to be fun. Called Living Large. Details are on the way. This program is supported by listeners, and I have a few I want to thank. Christopher Welch, Binghamton, New York. He's a new one. Monthly subscribers include Leanne Rayer, Margaret Anderson, Nancy Kilgore, Paul L. Seltzer of Durham, California, Edward Mayfield of Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and Dan Johnson has joined the party, too, from Lansing, Michigan. Each and every one of you have my gratitude for your support of the Peter B. Collins podcast program. The EHM has returned. John Perkins has a new book called Hoodwinked. And you may recall his bestseller was on the New York Times list for over a year, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. He's out of the confessional and perhaps into the pulpit. We'll find out how he feels. Obama's taking care of business. Our bailout money providing huge bonuses on Wall Street this year. And they haven't even let it trickle down to us yet. John Perkins has some pithy commentary on the 2008 Bush-Pelosi-Obama economic meltdown in his new book, Hoodwinked. And we got to bust his chops for subtitle creep. This is one of the longest I've seen in a while. An economic hitman reveals why the world financial markets imploded and what we need to do to remake them. John, welcome back to our show.
Thanks. It's great being with you again. And incidentally, I didn't write the subtitle. You can blame that on Random House.
Happy to do so. And, John, I've always enjoyed talking with you. This may be our fourth time since you published the Confessions book, six, 7 years ago?
It was late 2004.
Yeah, okay, not quite that long ago.
Time flies, doesn't it, Peter?
And I have to say that my program episodes that have featured you have been some of the most popular, most requested, and since we shifted to the podcast mode, most downloaded programs. So there's a lot of interest in you and your background and what you bring to the conversation. And for those who aren't familiar with your earlier books, briefly a description of what an economic hitman is and what you did for the consulting firm called Maine.
I'm glad to hear about the popularity there. I hope they like what I have to say. They're not just listening because they think I'm crazy. But anyway, I think it's fair to say, Peter, that we economic hitmen have created the world's first truly global empire. And it's an empire that's been created for the first time in history, primarily without the military, but through economics. And economic hitmen work many different ways, but I think the most common is that we will identify a third world country with resources that are desirous to our corporations, like oil, and then arrange a huge loan to that country through the World Bank or one of its sisters. And yet the money never actually goes to that country. Instead, it goes to our own corporations to build big infrastructure projects in that country, things like power plants and highways and industrial parks that benefit a few wealthy families in that country, as well as our own corporations, but don't help the majority of the people who are too poor to buy electricity or drive cars on highways, can't get jobs in industrial parks. In effect, industrial parks don't employ many people anyway. But these people, the majority of the people in the country, the whole country is left holding a huge debt that it can never repay. And so at some point, we economic hitmen go back and say, since you can't pay your debts, you got to do us some big favors. Sell your oil real cheap to our oil companies with no environmental restrictions. Vote with us on some current United Nations vote. Allow us to build a military base in your country or something like that.
Well, there's bust the unions, and please open up your markets to foreign investors, mostly Americans.
Right, exactly. Open up all of your markets and let us use slave labor. There's all kinds of things. You know it. And in the few occasions when we fail, when we're not able to bring those people around, and I talk in Hoodwinked about how I was not able to convince the democratically elected president of Ecuador, Jaime Roldós, or the head of state of Panama, Omar Torrijos, to accept these deals. On those occasions, we send in the jackals to either overthrow governments or assassinate them. Both Roldós and Torrijos were assassinated because they would not be corrupted.
And Torrijos gave you the phrase that became the title of the book.
He did. You know, he said to me, I'm trying to convince him to come over to our ways. He said, look, Juanito, he called me Juanito. He said, look, you know, I don't need your damn money. I got a good car. I got a good house. I got all the food I need. I got a good life.
And I got girls. I've got girls on Contadora Island.
Yeah. Well, as you know, in the book I talk about it. This is happening on a yacht that had all these amazingly beautiful bikini-clad Panamanian women on board that he's pointing out to me. We've got everything we need here. Why don't you come join us instead of having your life? And you know, he said, you know, what I need is to get the canal back in Panamanian hands and to get Yankee imperialism out of Panama and all of Latin America. And he said, you know, you need that too. He said, the United States is becoming like Spain was back in the colonial period. You have a predatory form of capitalism, and the end it implodes just like it did in Spain. It's going to implode on you too. Not only is your form of capitalism going to destroy the Panamanian economy, it's going to destroy your own economy. And, of course, he was right. It did. And then he said to me, no permites que te engañan, which in Spanish translates to don't allow them to hoodwink you. And, you know, he said, you're being hoodwinked, and you're hoodwinking everybody else. You got to change that.
And, Juanito, just a quick sidebar. You live in Florida, and have you ever taken the opportunity to go visit Manuel Noriega?
I don't think it's very easy to visit Manuel Noriega, and nor do I have any desire to visit him. I do go to Panama frequently. I was just there, and I'm going there in a couple of weeks to speak at a big event down there. So I keep in touch with Panama, but not with Manuel Noriega.
Is he a political prisoner, in your view?
I think there's no question about it. He is.
Yeah.
You know, and there's this huge question of why on earth did we send troops in to take out this President Noriega, and in the process kill something between 2,000 and 6,000 innocent citizens of Panama and destroy a large section of the city. It's an amazing thing that we did.
Yeah.
And, you know, we simply accused Noriega of being a drug lord and interfering with U.S. policies. But, in fact, Panama didn't even have an armed forces.
And why
no threat to the United States whatsoever.
Why was he treated in that manner and Baby Doc got the sweet package in the south of France? I'm referring to Duvalier from Haiti, by the way.
Of Haiti, yes, of course. And well, you know, I talk about this in my books, and that I've never been able to answer that question satisfactorily, except there are these rumors abounding, and they are an explanation that makes a certain amount of sense. The rumors are that on Contadora Island, which is where I had this conversation with Torrijos, and which had been a place for many years where people like me, economic hitmen, would take businessmen and politicians out of sight of everybody in the press and their wives to prefer a lot of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. You know, sex, drugs, and booze, and it was famous for that. That's where you basically wined and dined people. And during Torrijos's time, it was a sort of a protected island. But the rumors were that when Noriega took over after Torrijos's assassination, of course, many people think Noriega was involved in the assassination along with the CIA. When Noriega took over, the rumor is that he planted cameras all over the place, and he had the negatives on George Bush, who the elder's son, who of course became president later. He took these negatives to George Bush Sr., and he had the negatives on other politicians.
These are photographic negatives.
Photographic negatives. Uh-huh. Yes.
Not pollster negatives.
Right, no, photograph. He had the evidence and was using it to blackmail members of Congress and corporate leaders, and including the president's son. Now, I can't substantiate these rumors, mm-hmm. but the fact of the matter is we do know that after the bombing of Panama City, a whole section of the city was up in flames. Afterwards, U.S. troops went in and searched through the rubble, and one of the buildings that was taken down was the building that had the archives, that had information. If this sort of information existed, it undoubtedly would have been in that building. So the rumor makes a lot of sense to me. It's the only thing that does make sense to me. I can see no other reason why the United States did what it did.
Now, John, are you familiar with Naomi Klein's work and her description of disaster capitalism?
Sure. Shock therapy, shock capitalism. Yes, I am.
Yeah. And how consistent is that with your experience?
Very. And 9/11 is a great example. After 9/11, shock therapy was used to scare us all into going shopping more and attacking Iraq, Afghanistan, whoever. And of course, we all know now that Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. It was used as an excuse to launch a huge war against terrorism around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And this, you know, Peter, there's really no such thing as terrorism. There are people who commit acts of terror.
Yeah.
But it's not an ism.
No.
Catholicism is an ism.
Yeah.
Socialism is an ism.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've met terrorists, people who commit acts of terror in Colombia, FARC members. I've met them in Egypt and in Iran. I've met Somali pirates. They have nothing in common with each other. There's no ism there. These are desperate people who have very different causes for anger and for doing what they do. But it's not an ism. It's not a united force. To talk about a war on world terrorism is absurd.
Mm-hmm.
There's no such thing as world terrorism. There are acts of terror, and usually conducted by desperate people. If we want to get rid of terrorism, we need to get rid of the roots of terrorism. There'll probably always be fanatics. You know, there'll always be mass murderers and rapists. And I suspect that Bin Laden is a crazy fanatic. But they don't get followers unless they're desperate, miserable people, people who are starving, who don't know how to feed their families. Somali pirates who basically are fishermen whose fishing waters have been destroyed
mm-hmm.
by foreign fleets and by nuclear waste coming from our nuclear navy that operates out of Diego Garcia, a huge base right in those waters.
Wait. Are you sympathetic to the Somali pirates?
Sympathetic, that's a good word.
Well,
I certainly understand where they're coming from, and I think what's most important is to have reach an understanding that the way to get rid of these things is to get rid of the causes.
Well, John, the reason I raise that is that a couple of weeks ago we did an interview series with the people from Project Censored. They're at Sonoma State University, and every year they publish a book with the 25 stories that were given limited coverage or totally blacked out by the American media. And the one that really surprised me was the depth and context of the Somali pirates. Because as it's reported in the corporate media in the United States, these are just bad guys on little boats with AK-47s who go out and take over ships and demand ransom.
Yep.
And they keep the focus very simple, and we had the heroic moment earlier in 2009 when President Obama gave the approval for a Navy SEAL to make this incredible shot. It seems like a Hollywood shot to me, because he was floating on a boat up and down, and he was able to kill the pirate and not shoot the American from Vermont, who was the hostage captain of the ship that they had taken. And we never get any context on why the Somali pirates are taking this action, how their fisheries have been invaded because there's no Navy or other government in Somalia, and the dumping that you referred to by the United States and many others. And all we hear about is like Johnny Depp has left the Caribbean for the Somali coastline.
Yeah, I know. And what we need to understand is that those Somali pirates have very legitimate gripes. And they've actually, for over 20 years, gone to the UN and other authoritative international bodies and asked for help, saying that their fishing waters are being destroyed. They can no longer feed their families. And they reached a point of desperation where they weren't feeding their families, and they saw their only recourse. I heard interviews with them, and I myself have interviewed a number of what we call terrorists, none of whom want to be a terrorist. They all say, this is an incredibly dangerous way to make a living. I'm a farmer. I'm a fisherman. I just want to get back on my farm or to my fishing boat, but I can't. And so I have to feed my family, and you've left me no choice.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really sad. You know, the same thing is true of FARC, this famous Colombian organization, the terrorist organization. I was there in Colombia in the 70s when it really got started. And it got started because my own company was flooding their lands with hydroelectric projects, and the oil companies were destroying their lands by digging for oil and dumping waste oil down the rivers. And so people came together to protest, and then they took up arms to try to keep people off their land. And they were originally financed to a certain degree by Russia and even China. But when the financing went away, when detente happened and so on, they turned increasingly to drugs and extortion. And now that's become a large part of their business, is drugs and extortion. And I also think, you know, there's a lot of evidence that our own people, or the CIA, is very involved in some of that drug running. They use it to support, to finance the clandestine activities that they can't get financing for through the U.S. Congress. Again, I don't have proof of this, but there's a lot of evidence that these sorts of things are going on. What I do know is that all the terrorists I've ever met, and I've interviewed quite a few of them, quote, terrorists, none of them want to be terrorists. They're basically innocent people who have been driven to desperation, and if we want to get rid of that, we need to get rid of the causes. We need to understand, Peter, that in order for us to have homeland security in the United States, we have to understand that the whole world is our homeland. And as long as people are exploited, suffering, they will stand up for their rights.
Mm-hmm. Now, John, a couple of minutes back, you mentioned 9/11 as kind of a starting point for the recent deterioration. And I'm one of those tinfoil hat guys, and I want to be really clear. I don't believe the official story of 9/11. Neither do I go to the extreme of jumping to a conclusion that it was a quote-unquote inside job. I don't have proof of that. But I don't believe the 9/11 Commission's work. I know that they worked with hands tied behind their backs by the White House. They had a minder there in Philip Zelikow to make sure that they didn't stray into areas that would be embarrassing or might disclose things that are better kept under wraps. But to what extent do you believe that 9/11 was in some way permitted to happen or induced in an effort to create the so-called New Pearl Harbor that was used as a pivot point to justify the unjustifiable invasion of Iraq, and also to justify the invasion of Afghanistan, which many people rationalize, but which I don't think was a very good idea?
Well, like you, Peter, I have no evidence, and I don't like to speculate about such things. I like to talk about things where I do have evidence or I have personal experience. But, it's extremely difficult for me to believe the official story. I was in Ecuador on 9/11, and shortly, I was in the jungle, but when I came out several days later and was up in the Andes and finally got to look at television, they kept re-showing this picture of Osama bin Laden holding a walkie-talkie standing outside a cave in the Himalayan mountains, the mountains of Afghanistan, whatever mountains he was in.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept asking myself, can anybody really believe that a man with a walkie-talkie in a cave in these mountains directed a force that took down the World Trade Centers? Can anybody really believe that? It's extremely difficult to believe that could have happened.
And
certainly we know that the Bush administration and the corporatocracy, it's the Democrats as well as Republicans, let's face it,
yes,
have used this, and to Naomi Klein's phrase, you know, it's real shock therapy to get us all to go shopping and attack Iraq, which made no sense at all.
Mm-hmm.
But so you have to really look at who benefited most from 9/11.
So the invasion of Afghanistan, I do understand the desire, if Osama bin Laden was responsible, to capture him, kill him, or bring him to justice. But that move was bungled, and it's hard to believe that, you know, again, that this wasn't something either intentional or, you know, one of those failures of an omission type. But I can't justify the ongoing occupation of Afghanistan. A lightning strike, a special forces assault aimed at al-Qaeda, I think was defensible. But the idea that we should be running this country through our puppet Karzai, attempting to take on the opium trade there, which is extremely powerful, these indigenous warlords who have much greater loyalty than we can ever buy, and this amorphous enemy that we call the Taliban, which is really in Afghanistan at least an array of three insurgent forces, on the Pakistani side an array of a minimum of five insurgent forces. But in the president's speech on December 1st, he really dumbed it down, and I feel insulted personally, that it's just the Taliban and al-Qaeda. He's still avenging 9/11, and I'm sorry, the ongoing invasion of Afghanistan has no relationship to the U.S. national interest.
I totally agree with you, and it not only does it not have any relationship to our national interest, it's probably going to bring us down more and more and more. It brought the Soviet Union down. Let's remember that. That if there's any one single thing that can be cited for destroying the Soviet Union, it was Afghanistan.
You mean it wasn't when Reagan said tear down the wall?
Oh, I shouldn't, of course, dispute Reagan, should I? But, you know, we all know that Afghanistan really, really undermined the entire Soviet Union and mm-hmm. undermined their economy, and it's undermining ours. But, you know, I think what we have to look at, Peter, is that if you own or manage or have a large ownership share in Raytheon or General Electric or General Dynamics or General Motors or one of the other big generals out
yeah.
there, you're awfully glad we're in Afghanistan because you're making a lot of money off of it. And, you know, you and I may think we lost the war in Vietnam and are not winning the war in Iraq, but if you happen to own one of those companies or a large share in one of them or manage them, we didn't lose the war in Vietnam, and we're not losing in Iraq and Afghanistan either because they're making billions.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's the sad part of this is somehow the American people get hoodwinked. Again, I talk about this in my book a lot. We've been hoodwinked into believing all these things, and the big corporations own our press, our mainstream press. They own the New York Times. They own NBC and CBS and ABC and Fox and CNN, and they're hoodwinking us. We're falling for it, and we got to turn this thing around. You know, it's why I write my books. It's why you do what you do,
mm-hmm.
and there's a lot of people out there doing what you and I both do, and that's good. And I think we are beginning to turn it around. We got to turn it around more. A large part of the book Hoodwinked is devoted to solutions. What can we do to change this? And I'm encouraged. I'm hopeful that we can change this. I talk about basically five different things that each mm-hmm. one of us can do, or we.
And let's get to that part in a moment, but first I want to talk about the early part of the book where you really set the stage and define the problems, and I fully embrace your analysis, which is the deregulation that started with the airlines and then was spread to savings and loans, and we had a brilliant ending to that with the Resolution Trust Corporation and billions of dollars of losses, including some attributable to Neil Bush at Silverado Savings and Loan. And the deregulation continued. And as we've discussed on a recent podcast with Nomi Prinz, she used to work at Goldman Sachs and other shops on Wall Street. And she talks passionately about the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, which was the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act. And you referenced that very affirmatively in the book as well, that was the turning point when we took away the firewall between consumer banks, commercial banks, and the investment banks, which are essentially casinos, where they take huge risks. And by removing this firewall, we ended up with the meltdown of 2008, and $13 trillion of U.S. taxpayer money has either been pumped into these institutions, pledged against their liabilities, or otherwise committed. And we're led to believe that the beginning and end of it is the $700 billion TARP fund. And gosh, some of that money's coming back so we can, you know, repurpose it for jobs and for some mortgage relief. But there's a whole lot of bullshit flying about what really occurred and how much has been put out there to try to put out the fires that Wall Street caused itself.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, it's when I went to business school in the late 60s, we were told that there could never be another depression like that in the 30s. In fact, we could never have a recession like the one that we've been having and are still having, because we put into effect rules and regulations that protected us against that. And my professors were right. We had. But we tore them all down. You mentioned Glass-Steagall. That's just one of many, and perhaps one of the more important ones. But we tore them all down. We did this under Glass-Steagall was under Clinton. We did this under Republicans and Democrats alike. So what happened really was, you know, we had been going along basically basing our economic policies on Keynesian economics, John Maynard Keynes. And everyone was a Keynesian. Nixon said that. He said, I'm a Keynesian. Everyone's a Keynesian. And then in the 70s, we began to use the Milton Friedman form of economics in our international business. And in 1980, Ronald Reagan totally embraced Milton Friedman in the Chicago School of Economics. And every U.S. president and most foreign presidents since, Democrat and Republican alike, including the current president, have embraced Milton Friedman's form of economics. It's a very, very selfish, a very predatory, and a very dangerous form of economics. Its three main premises are, one, the sole responsibility of business is to maximize profits in the short run, regardless of the social and environmental costs. Two, businesses shouldn't be regulated because that gets in the way of making profits. Three, everything should be run by private business. Everything should be privatized. Jails, schools, even the military should be privatized. Now, these three premises have, which never was the basis of capitalism before in the 400-year history of capitalism. We never had anything that extreme. And they've torn us down. They've created a world where a few wealthy, powerful people have become increasingly wealthy and powerful, and the rest of us have suffered terribly and been demeaned and been put in subservient positions. And it's really time for us to turn that around. But that is the basis of all of this, that philosophical point of economics. It's that bad dream. It's a nightmare. It's become a nightmare. And we've reached a point where less than 5% of the world's population here in the United States consume more than 25% of the world's resources. Roughly half the world is on the verge of starvation or actually starving. And what we've created, we know, is a failure. This is not a model. A system like that cannot be passed on to Africa or Asia or Latin America, India, China. You'd need another 5 or 6 planets to make it happen, and we don't have those. Mm-hmm. So we know it's a failure. We know we've got to change it.
John, tell our listeners a little bit about your experience as a CEO, because you were a consultant, globetrotting, doing this economic hitman role, and basically seducing foreign governments into overextending themselves and then coming in to clobber them when the crap hit the fan. But you were the CEO of Independent Power Systems, and that appeared to be a kind of a brutal learning experience for you.
Yeah, after I left off being an economic hitman, and incidentally, it was interesting because the woman who trained me, I talk and hoodwinked a lot about Claudine Martin, who trained me, a very seductive, very cunning, very intelligent woman who brought me into this field, using every means of seduction to do so. She told me, you know, once you're in, you can't get out. Well, when I decided to get out, I decided I wouldn't talk about it. I would go into another business that was related. So I went into the alternative energy business. Became CEO of an alternative energy company. It was a good company. We developed environmentally beneficial power plants and energy sources, and it was based on a law that was passed in 1978 and then reinforced by the Supreme Court in 82 called PURPA, Public Utilities Regulatory Act. Policy Act, and it was set up to help small companies, entrepreneurs, develop alternative forms of energy and force the electric companies to buy that energy. Seemed like a great thing, and we were successful. But after about 10 years in this business, what I discovered is that all the rules were changed again, or the regulations were, in fact, dropped, so that now the big companies were putting all of us in a position where they could buy us out or essentially blackmail us to get out. And that's what happened to me. I had a very successful company, but along came the corporatocracy. In my case, it was Ashland Oil Company that essentially forced me out. In the end, I had no choice. I go into the details and hoodwinked, but I had to sell to Ashland Oil, or everything that I developed would have just totally gone down the tubes, and those plants would never have operated. They were good plants. I wanted to see them operate. They were environmentally good plants, and so I succumbed. I sold out.
And, John, what you just referenced seemed to be an expression of your own environmentalism. And in the book, the theme is pretty strong of a thread, that you actually care a lot about the planet and that you identify with the people of Ecuador, whose beautiful river systems and ecosystems have been just dreadfully damaged by Texaco, now Chevron. If people go to your website at johnperkins.org, they can take a look at some of the other books that you've written. You are a Renaissance man with many interests, including ecology and spirituality. But tell us a little bit about your own development in terms of becoming a more green person.
Well, it started when I was a kid. I grew up in rural New Hampshire. My parents were very deep environmentalists, although we didn't call them that at the time. I come from about 300 years of Yankee farmers, Vermont and New Hampshire farmers, and farmers back in those days tended to be very, very ecological. You know, you didn't do anything that was going to destroy the land, and things were done basically, or what we call today, organically. That's what I grew up with, and then I went to business school, and even in business school, again, at the time I was in business school, we were taught that a good CEO takes care of the environment and communities. It's not just about maximizing profits in the short run. This was in the 60s. And then I went in the Peace Corps and lived in the Amazon and lived in the Andes, lived with indigenous people, and saw their incredible attitude toward environmentalism. It really impacted me. And then I went to work for this consulting firm in Boston. I became chief economist, and in essence, I was an economic hitman. This woman, Claudine Martin, again, prepped me for that job. But basically what I did nothing illegal, should be illegal, but it wasn't and isn't. And in fact, it was promoted by all the business schools, so I could convince myself that what I was doing was the right thing in seducing these countries into accepting these huge loans and basically destroying their environments in the process. But over time, it took me 10 years to really, really understand the implications of what I was doing. I could see, because perhaps my own background, that what we were doing was terribly, terribly wrong, and that's when I got out. In the early 80s, realizing that what we were doing was terribly wrong.
And tell a little bit of the story about the Shuars, Shakaim and Twitsa, and what they taught you.
Yeah, these are Shua. The Shua live deep in the Amazon. It's where I was a Peace Corps volunteer in 1968 and for 3 years and became very close to them. I'm still very close to them. I go back fairly frequently and visit them. I have godchildren there. Shua are an indigenous tribe that still a large part of their tribe lives much as they have for centuries. And they taught me, to really respect nature and our relationship with nature. I have a recollection, Peter, of one time not so long ago when I took an overnight hike with two young Shua men up to their sacred waterfalls. Actually, it was two nights. When we came back, just as we were approaching the community, they stopped and looked at this little plant, and they said, "This plant's sick. We've got to tell the elders." To me, the plant didn't even look sick, but they noticed something about it. We had a meeting of elders that night, and after a long night of discussions, the elders decided that although there was no proof that it was happening, that the sickness in that plant might indicate that the trail was being overused. And so they decided to close down that trail and never use it again because nature was sending a signal. And I flew back from there several days later, and landed in Miami. And as I'm driving north to West Palm Beach, Florida, in a car, I'm listening to the radio, and there's this huge debate going on in the United States about whether global warming is really caused by human beings and dumping carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And since we don't have any proof that it actually is, then maybe we shouldn't do anything about it. And I was struck by the incredible contrast between these, quote, primitive, unquote, people in the Amazon and us, this highly civilized, scientific society that we live in, and how the primitive people are smart enough to understand that if there's any possibility that what they're doing is hurting their children's futures, then they ought to stop doing it. Whereas we seem to need absolute evidence, and, you know, we should learn something from the Schwa, that if there's any possibility that anything we're doing today is jeopardizing the future for my grandson and every other child on this planet, then we ought to change our ways.
And, John, as you referenced a few minutes ago, you do offer some concrete ideas about what we should be doing, and we're already underperforming, but let me read a couple of quotes here. Although we need the modern equivalent of the Glass-Steagall Act, the Bank Holding Company Act, and so many of the others that were dropped after 1980, we must not stop there. This nation deserves a whole new set of rules and regulations that ensure a sustainable, just, and peaceful world for my grandson and all his brothers and sisters. It deserves an accounting system that internalizes the externalities. I think you're referring to Enron accounting there. And in doing so, ensures that the most socially and environmentally responsible businesses enjoy a competitive edge over others instead of vice versa. The cancer that lurks beneath this economic crisis will not be cured merely by addressing the problems of the banking, insurance, and auto industries. Like a patient after his cancerous lung has been removed who must quit smoking if he wants a healthy life, our long-term health depends on addressing the underlying causes. Now, with Larry Summers, Tim Geithner, and occasionally Paul Volcker in the mix there, do you have any confidence that we'll have systemic reforms?
I do, because you're talking about this to a lot of people right now. My books have sold millions of copies, and you know, there's a lot of movies being made about these subjects now and other books out there. And as I travel around the country, and I just came back this year from China, from Iceland, from traveling around Latin America, I hear young people, particularly all over the world, saying we've got to change. I hear young people that are in MBA programs, getting their master's degree in business, the future leaders here and in China and in Latin America and all over and in Africa, saying that we've got to turn this around. So I do have hope, despite those jerks that are currently running our economic system out of Washington. I think that there's something much greater than that going on today. I think we are beginning to wake up. And I'm hoping that, you know, Obama's failure is going to help us all to wake up. I think people are beginning to understand that the president really doesn't have that much power. And if he tries to use it, he'll probably be shot down one way or another. But we, the people, have the power. We've always had the power. Women didn't get the right to vote in this country because Woodrow Wilson was pro-suffrage. He wasn't. Women got the right to vote because they demonstrated for it for many years. And they followed Wilson around as he traveled across the country trying to whip up support for the U.S. getting involved in a war in Europe to protect democracy in Europe. Women followed him around, and they shouted, and they carried placards, and they said, listen, we're not going to send our men off to fight for democracy in Europe when we don't have democracy here. Half of us, all the women in this country, can't vote. Give us the right to vote, and then maybe we'll consider going to war to protect Europe. It made sense. Woodrow listened, and he passed the law that gave women the right to vote. Time and time again, Peter, we've seen this. We must do it. We can't look to our leaders to do it. We must force them to do it.
Well, I appreciate your optimism. My problem is that Obama consciously chose continuity instead of change, particularly when it came to the economic crisis that he inherited. And my metaphor is that we're rebuilding sandcastles and that we're not making any systemic changes. We're not imposing any real regulation or trading rules for hedge funds, for the derivatives that are at the core of this crisis. And while executive compensation is not a central issue to me, the fact that these Wall Street people are paying themselves these huge bonuses off our bailouts is infuriating and indicative that they don't have any intention of changing.
You are you know, you hit the nail on the head. I couldn't agree with you more thoroughly. Obama's done a miserable job, and he's probably a one-term president unless something pretty radical happens.
I share that concern.
But I think, I hope that we, the people, are waking up in the process and understanding that this is not about politics. And in fact, you know, we're at a time in history today, Peter, that's like when the city-states became nations, except today the nations are becoming irrelevant, and so are presidents. Even the president of the United States is becoming irrelevant. We used to look at the world as 200 countries, roughly, of which a few had a lot of power, the United States, the Soviet Union, et cetera. Today, we really look at the world as these 200 countries, but covered by swirling clouds that know no national borders, don't listen to any particular sets of laws. These are the big corporations. They're calling the shots today. They're the ones who financed the Obama campaign. That's why their people are now in the White House, whether it's Monsanto or Goldman Sachs. They're calling the shots. And even if you were elected, if we had elected a president who'd taken no money from the corporations, he'd still have to deal with a Congress that had taken money from the corporations. He'd mm-hmm. still have to deal with 35,000 corporate lobbyists in Washington, D.C. alone. So the corporations are controlling this, but we the people need to understand that the corporations are dependent on us. They don't survive unless we buy their goods and services. And if we start really pressuring them, you know, in the past, we've been successful at getting them to clean up polluted rivers, to stop supporting apartheid in South Africa, to hire more women and minorities, to recently to get rid of trans fats and hormones in chickens.
Mm-hmm.
And now we need to ratchet this up a notch and say, listen, let's get rid of that goal of maximizing profits regardless of the social and environmental costs. And we'll only buy from companies that are committed to making a profit, okay, but only within the context of creating a sustainable, just, and peaceful world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if every one of your audience sends an email to Nike today and says, we're not buying from you anymore because you still have sweatshops in Indonesia, Nike's going to have to turn those sweatshops into legitimate factories that have reasonable working conditions and pay their people living wages. Or they're going to go out of business if we refuse to buy from them unless they turn around. We need to do that. And then, of course, we need to codify laws that will insist that companies do these things.
Well, and John, one of the fixes that I think is brilliant in its simplicity, and I'm not just trying to pat myself on the back here, but built into our system, the corporate governance system, is a thing called fiduciary responsibility. And I believe that if we strung up a couple of corporate directors who have failed to honor their obligation to shareholders over management, that we would see a curbing of the excessive executive compensation. We would see a change from this quarter by quarter, inflate the profits, do whatever you have to make the books look good, because our bonuses depend on that. And I really feel that the fiduciary rule is the one area that has not been properly enforced, and that if we simply addressed that, that we would see these boards bring their corporations into line pretty quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, I talk a lot about that at Hoodwinked. And the fact that we also, you know, we the people have glorified the robber barons. You know, we've put people like Jack Welch, the former CEO of General Electric, up on a pedestal.
And I was a Tyco shareholder. You go into some depth about Dennis Kozlowski, who fleeced me.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, these guys are robber barons, and we put them on the cover of Fortune and Time and every other magazine out there. We've made them emblems for our children to emulate. We need to turn that around, you know. We need to put people like Peter Collins on the cover of Fortune magazine. We need to have a Fortune 500 list of the people who are doing the most to create a better planet for us, our children and grandchildren, not those who fly around in private jets and have huge yachts.
So I take it you're not excited that Ben Bernanke is Time's Man of the Year.
Isn't that amazing?
yeah,
that tells you a lot about Time magazine, doesn't it, Peter?
We're failing upward.
Yeah, isn't that incredible?
Yeah.
Yeah.
John,
you know, we're buying Time magazine, right? I mean, people are out there buying it, and they're reading about Ben Bernanke. I'm not. I don't need to read another word about Ben Bernanke any more than I need to read another word about Tiger Woods. You know, speaking of that, Isn't it interesting that here's a guy, Tiger Woods, who's made I don't know how many hundreds of millions of dollars off Nike and a lot of other corporations that have sweatshops in Indonesia hiring people of his color, and not even hiring them, basically enslaving them, putting them to work under terrible conditions. He's never objected, and nobody's ever faulted him for that. You know, nobody's brought Tiger Woods down because he makes millions and millions of dollars on the backs of starving slaves in Indonesia. But suddenly he has a lot of extramarital sex, and everybody's attacking him. And, you know, I'm not condemning extramarital sex here at all.
Me either.
what I am saying is that it's fascinating how our media really goes after that stuff, but they don't go after him for what I think is a much greater crime. Mm-hmm. That is accepting hundreds of millions of dollars that have come right off the back of poor, starving slaves in sweatshops around the world.
John, as we wrap up here, you and I have a friend in common, Randy Hayes, and you tell the story again in this book of winding up in a hot tub with him and the executive from Mitsubishi, who he had successfully campaigned against regarding their foresting practices. And he is a guy who I feel inspired by. And you also mentioned Lynn Twist and the Pachamama Alliance. And I'm familiar with their work. I've met Lynn and went to one of their amazing fundraisers where they describe the work that they do in the Amazon. And these are just two examples of people who don't take no for an answer, who don't allow the status quo to get them to give up. And tell me why you cited them in the book and what passion they inspire in you.
Yeah, well, I talk a lot about both of them in the book, and I'm a co-founder of the Pachamama Alliance with Lynn and her husband, Bill. We're both on the board. I'm the one who took them to Ecuador and brought the message out from the Achua that really is behind the Pachamama Alliance. And yet they took that ball and really, really ran with it. If you went to one of their luncheon fundraisers, you've seen what they can do. And the money that they bring in goes down to help the indigenous people of the Amazon fight Texaco and Chevron and the other oil companies that are hell-bent on destroying the rainforest. They do amazing work. Randy Hayes, founder of Rainforest Action Network, is an incredible human being, you know, with an amazing sense of conscience and an amazing sense of a vision of for the future that will allow us all to survive. I have such deep respect for people like that. These are the people that should be gracing the covers of our magazines and our books, and there are a lot of them out there. But we somehow as a society have chosen to really hero worship those who make a lot of money, who live in mansions, who have their own private jets and yachts, rather than the ones that are willing to accept very little pay but do something that will really create a better world. And I would say, Peter, and I'm sure you know this because you're one of these people, that there's nothing more gratifying than devoting yourself to creating a better world for us and for our children and grandchildren. I often think of when I was an economic hitman, I traveled first class in airplanes. I stayed in the best hotels. I wined and dined amazingly beautiful women and met with heads of state. And I was taking a hell of a lot of Valium. I was drinking a lot of alcohol. I was miserable. I went through a terrible divorce. Now I'm happy. I don't travel first class anymore, and I don't usually stay in very good hotels. I usually stay with friends if I possibly can, or cheap hotels. But I'm so happy now. You know, I'm doing something very, very powerful and something I really believe in, creating a better world for my grandson, and knowing that the only way my grandson's going to have a better world is every child in every country, in every community, in every village on this planet has a better world. And there's nothing more gratifying than doing that. There's nothing more fun than doing that. And I know you know that, too. And I really encourage all your listeners to devote themselves to using their individual passions and talents to really create a better world.
Juanito, you've come a long way, baby.
Yeah, and I'm having a lot more fun now that I have.
John Perkins. The book is Hoodwinked, and we blame his editor for the lengthy subtitle. Once again, an economic hitman reveals why the world financial markets imploded and what we need to do to remake them. I read it cover to cover, and it's a great read. John, thank you.
Thank you, Peter. Thanks for all the great work you're doing. If I'm Juanito, you're Pedrito.
Adios, amigo.
Adios.
Peter B. Collins Show continues, sponsored by the Organic Wine Company. Now that you're eating organic, it's time to drink organic. Try the fine earth-friendly wines imported by the Organic Wine Company since 1980. Just click on the link on my homepage at peterbcollins.com for a very special introductory offer for Peter B. Collins Show listeners. Returning to our program today, Truth Outs correspondent in Buenos Aires, Sam Ferguson, who has been in South America for some time now, monitoring, covering the trials of those who participated in torture and other illegal activities decades ago. Sam Ferguson, welcome back to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me again.
You've provided excellent coverage, and the stories that we're going to discuss today have gotten very little play in the American media, at least to my knowledge. And as you pointed out in an analysis piece that was published at truthout.org on December 11, there's a trial for torture underway, and you describe this in terms that could apply to the United States of America, but unfortunately, we don't appear to be there yet. And what you describe is the origins of the current trials, the ESMA trials, and we'll explain what ESMA means and what is being covered in the scope of those proceedings. But from your perch there, currently in summertime, South America, you have offered some interesting comments about the slow pace of any investigations, the very limited investigations that our Attorney General Eric Holder announced earlier this year. And you make some interesting comparisons. So first up, as you point out in this piece and you've discussed with us in the past, in Argentina in particular, there have been a kind of push and pull moments regarding the restoration of democracy and accountability for those who were responsible for torture, the disappearance of as many as 30,000 Argentinians back during this dark era. And why don't you reprise this a little bit for our listeners as to what comparisons you see and what differences you see?
Yeah, well, there's a few parallels between what's going on here in Argentina and what's going on in the United States, not necessarily in terms of what the governments did specifically. I mean, I think that it's hard to compare the scope of the repression here in Argentina with what happened in the United States, not to justify what happened in the United States, but there are obvious places where the analogy breaks down. That said, it's interesting following these trials down here to see a number of similar objections that are made here to the trials and have been made throughout the decades that are the same reasons that are being put forth in the United States. One of those, for instance, is that, well, we shouldn't prosecute torture because the torturers, in fact, are the people who saved the legal order. Here in Argentina, it's something you hear from segments of the right that, no, we can't prosecute the torturers because they won a war against leftist terrorism, and we should praise them for saving the nation. Now, this argument's been rejected here because Argentines, I believe, rightly recognize that widespread torture did more damage to the legal order and did more damage to the nation than the very threat it was supposed to be going after. So in a so-called dirty war, the Argentine military here completely destroyed the legal regime and destroyed the justice system. And unfortunately, that we seem to have chipped away at the legitimacy and the rule of law, and that the criminal statute should be applied equally to all citizens, no matter what their position of power. Another thing that another objection that's frequently raised in the United States is the impossibility of figuring out who you actually should prosecute for torture, if anybody. Should we go after the people at the top, or should we go after the agents in the room when suspected terrorists were being interrogated and tortured? Now, here in Argentina, there's been a long back and forth with this debate. In the 80s, when they initially tried to prosecute the military for torture, the government of Raul Alfonsín wanted to go after the officials at the top, saying essentially that the officials in the room were just following orders. But recently, the Supreme Court here has ruled that no orders to torture can legitimately be followed because an order to torture is manifestly illegal, and they cite international law and international precedent to justify this. So here in Argentina, they're prosecuting the highest officials from the last military government for their responsibility in ordering torture, right down to the policemen and the sailors and the soldiers in the room who did that. Now, finally, one thing that has bounced around in the United States is that what happened wasn't actually torture. Now, this is just preposterous, because back in the 1970s, the late Senator Kennedy helped lead a movement to sanction the government of Argentina for what here is known as the submarino, or mm-hmm. the submarine. Now, that's what we today call waterboarding. The language has changed, but what is actually done to detainees is exactly the same. So it's interesting that this was a problem for the United States government, that other countries around the world were using this procedure in the 1970s, and today we seem to call it a quote-unquote enhanced interrogation technique, and it's not torture as we used to call it.
And Sam, what about the situational ethics, the moral relativism that was marshaled by right-wingers in this country who ordinarily talk about personal responsibility as a very high moral value, and yet in the face of the arguments they raise that, oh, we were only doing this to keep America safe, and a ticking time bomb could have gone off, and we're doing everything we can, and there is a presumption of guilt on the part of those administering this torture. And, for example, we've seen in our careful coverage of the Guantanamo situation that fully two-thirds of the men detained there were completely innocent of any involvement in terrorism, any attacks on the United States in any way, shape, or form. And yet their very presence at Guantanamo was used to confer guilt upon them and then justify any means that we might take to extract information from them. Now, putting aside the fallacies that, you know, many of them were, if they were actual terrorists, were compartmentalized to the point that they didn't have any useful information, and that the torture continued long after any fresh information that they might have about a pending attack, for example, was the shelf life had expired. And so I've got a real long question for you here, but I'm just wondering if there are any parallels that those who rationalize the actions that were taken in Argentina in the 70s use some of the same arguments and mentalities that we saw here.
Yeah, well, there was a common saying during the 1970s about the people who were disappearing that they used to say, well, it must have happened for something. And that was kind of the way that society dealt with the fact that people were just disappearing from the streets, that you might be walking around one day on a busy commercial avenue or the subway or getting onto a bus, and a group of civilian-dressed government officials would snatch one of your neighbors up off the street. And it's interesting. I mean, the question of how much people in Argentina knew is an interesting one, but that phrase, it must have happened for some reason, suggests that people kind of knew what was going on. And to be able to deal with these extra legal means, they simply blamed the victims. Now, this is not to say that all of the people being held in Guantanamo are innocent, or all of the people here in Argentina who were kidnapped by the government were innocent. Indeed, there was a leftist movement they were targeting, and a small minority of the people that the government ended up snatching up had indeed been involved in terrorism. But the point is that the government has the responsibility to bring people to trial, to try them openly and publicly, and apply the laws they would against anybody else. And so it's interesting what the democracy here did after the fall of the military dictatorship, prosecute not only the military, but they also initiated prosecutions against the head of the terrorist organizations, against several members still left who had headed the terrorist organizations. And that's, you know, what should happen in the United States, that certainly some of these people are probably guilty of terrorism, but we don't know that until they're tried publicly in a civilian court, and we should be pushing for that.
And as we're discussing this, I'm kind of shifting to some of the content of the post at truthout.org dated December 15th, Unrepentant Blonde Angel and 18 Others from the ESMA Stand Trial. And in it, you recount the on-again, off-again amnesty rulings or laws that were first passed, and then they were overturned by courts. And there's been a real struggle over that question. And I want to put it to you this way, that in the United States, we have a de facto amnesty that has been just kind of artificially imposed by President Obama and Attorney General Holder, which I don't think will last. At least that's my aspiration. But in Pakistan right now, amnesties that were granted a couple of years ago after the Musharraf government was winding down and a return to democracy was, you know, hoped for. I can't really say they have democracy today, but it's not a general who's running the country. So the amnesties in Pakistan are expiring, and it's creating a situation where the courts appear to be the dominant player in a three-part government. And when we look at it here in the United States, as I say, we don't have a real amnesty law or anything that is substantive. We just have the desire of this president not to prosecute these crimes. And so I'm curious from your point of view, based on the Argentine experience, if you have any guess of how this will proceed in the future here in the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the reasons why we don't see much movement on this in the United States is the history of prosecutorial discretion in the United States. The prosecutors in the U.S. have extensive leeway in whether to bring charges, why to bring charges, against whom, weighing difficult legal and factual questions against other work they might have in the office. And that appears to me what's happening within the Obama administration. I mean, giving them the benefit of the doubt and full faith and credit. I don't know if they're deserving of that, but I mean, that's the best possible reading of what's going on. And my response to that would be, I mean, certainly it's within Attorney General Holder's right to say, look, the legal questions involved in this are horrendously complicated, whether CIA agents involved in extraordinary rendition have the legal cover from memos coming from the White House saying what they were doing was legal, whether you can prosecute John Yoo, a lawyer, for bad legal decisions. I mean, more than attempting to disbar him, criminal prosecution is another thing. And mm-hmm. I think that what's happening is the Obama administration is weighing these and saying this is too complicated. It's not clear that we would win. The political costs are too high. Let's not do this.
But Sam, I think that your final point there about the political costs is what's driving this. And that's where I depart, because this kind of administrative amnesty that is in effect right now is outside of our Constitution and our criminal statutes. And I don't want to simply make a call that Don Rumsfeld is guilty. I want a process. I want to see this fully investigated. And I want to really identify those who framed the policy and authorized the so-called enhanced interrogation techniques. And I'd like all that to be done in a deliberative and transparent manner. I'm not simply, you know, calling for vigilante justice. But, you know, for us to simply turn a blind eye and say, we're not going to go there, we're not going to open this up, I think undermines our criminal justice system in a very definitive way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I think that we can't be certain that these people are definitively guilty at this point. I mean, but the point is that we should subject certain people who are suspected of ratifying enhanced interrogation techniques, as they call them, and have them face the courts and let judges settle this matter in a public open forum. The way that it's happening right now, you're right, it's being dealt with behind the scenes by Attorney General Holder. The reasons why they might be withholding prosecution are not transparent, are not clear, And
Sam, just last week here in San Francisco at the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, the Obama Justice Department renewed the arguments that there can be no trials over rendition, over the role that Jeppesen Aviation, a San Jose offshoot of Boeing, which essentially was the travel agency for these international flights to torture, that this is all off limits and that it cannot be explored in any way, shape, or form in our federal courts. And I find that high-handed, and I find it quite insulting, frankly.
Yeah, well, we'll see. Fortunately, the Obama administration doesn't get the last word on that. The courts do. But, I mean, it's I suppose, understandable that the executive branch of the government would be arguing for that sort of position. I mean, Obama, after all, is the executive, and he does ironically retain certain interests that the Bush administration did, like any other executive agency did. But that's exactly why we have courts, to counterbalance these sorts of arguments, to weigh them against the arguments of victims in these cases who say, wait a minute, like executive privilege, like why should that shield me from bringing a civil suit for torts claims for extraordinary rendition? I don't see the connection. But there is a judicial process with these civil suits going on, and I mean, I suppose the cynic in me would say that any administration would advance those same interests. It might be disappointing to a lot that the Obama administration would not change positions from the Bush administration, but at some level, the interest in presidential power unfortunately trumps the interest in accountability.
You're correct about that. Now, ESMA is the Spanish acronym for Argentina's Naval Mechanics School, and this was, in loose terms, their Guantanamo. This is where they sent people to be interrogated, to be held, and this is where people were tortured. This is where they were disappeared from. Some of them were drugged and put on helicopters or airplanes and just thrown out over the ocean there. Tell us a little bit about some of the people who are on trial now, including the guy whose nom de guerre is the Blonde Angel.
Yeah, so Alfredo Astiz is the most well-known of the 19 defendants in this case. He is known by his fellow sailors as Rubio or Angel, which means blonde or angel, because of his blonde tuft of hair and his kind of boyish young looks. He was 23 and 24 when the majority of the crimes occurred. And to his detractors, he's known as the Blonde Angel of Death. In 1977, Astiz is accused of infiltrating the mothers of the Plaza de Mayo and other relatives of victims of the repressive campaign of the Argentine military. He approached the mothers and other relatives of the victims, claiming that his brother, too, had been disappeared by the Argentine military. And over the course of several months, he met with these people. He helped them raise funds. He helped them challenge the federal police when they were chased away from the plaza. And eventually, in a series of raids between December 8th and December 10th, prosecutors here alleged that Astiz helped sailors from the ESMA mark a dozen activists who were looking for their relatives who had disappeared. And intelligence units from the ESMA swooped them up off the streets, including seven of whom were disappeared from a church meeting. They were brought to the ESMA. Over the next 2 weeks, they were savagely tortured, held in tiny cells, and eventually it seems as though they were all loaded onto a cargo plane and thrown out into the South Atlantic. Now, one of the horrifying but ultimately good things for people who are interested in seeing justice done for Astiz is that several of these bodies washed up on shore about 2 weeks after the incident. And the bodies, after advances in DNA evidence, were eventually identified in 2005, which has helped corroborate the stories of many of the survivors who were in the ESMA and saw this all happen. By saying, in fact, these bodies were thrown into the river, and we can prove that there were 12 homicides here. So Astiz has been accused of kidnapping, torture, and homicide in the disappearance of these 12 people, known as the Grupo Santa Cruz, along with 10 of the other defendants in the case.
And you have a quote here from Astiz regarding his infiltration of this group of mothers who were seeking information and the return of their children. Quote, "I didn't betray them because I was never one of them. What I did was infiltrate, and this is what they won't forgive me for. Because I infiltrated them two times. When they accuse me of other things, I get mad, but for this, I laugh." And here's my parallel to some of the current investigations in the United States or over the last 5 to 6 years, Sam. And that is in Miami, in Lodi, California, in Lackawanna, New York, and in other instances where the government has tried people for alleged terrorist connections or terrorist intentions. There has always been a paid government informant, a provocative infiltrator who was suggesting illegal activities to these people who trusted their provocateur. And so I think that's somewhat of an interesting parallel here. And from this quote, it seems that Astiz is very proud of what he did in betraying the trust of these women that he infiltrated.
Yeah, so full disclosure, this statement was part of a 1998 interview that he gave to a journalist named Gabriela Cerruti.
Mm-hmm.
And Astiz later claimed that she violated an off-the-record agreement and subsequently sued her. And in the court papers from the case, it seems as though Cerruti was not the most confident of journalists. There's a number of reasons why the direct quote maybe shouldn't be trusted.
All right.
But let me further explain that. It still shows this very interesting relationship that Astiz has had with the media over the years. I mean, in one way, it shows Astiz's brilliance, that he gave this interview to a left-wing journalist. He knew that she might sensationalize what he said, but he still did it without her taking notes, without her recording anything, so he knew that later he might be able to deny everything and get the best of her.
Mm-hmm.
So it allowed Astiz in some way to say what he felt, to vindicate the fight of the 70s, but then later be able to deny that those were his actual words. And he's had this kind of sinister relationship with the media and the taunting of victims of the dirty war for the last 20 years. In court the other day, as he was leaving in handcuffs just after the judges had retired, he had been holding a book in his lap the entire day. And at the end of the trial, as they're putting the handcuffs on him, and he holds the book up at the audience, the title of which is Volver a Matar, which means return to kill or to kill again. So Astiz continues to have this very high-profile, provocative relationship with Argentina and with the victims of the dirty war.
Mm-hmm. And tell us about Jorge Acosta, also known as Tigre.
Yeah, Jorge Acosta was head of the intelligence unit, so-called, of the ESMA, and he is accused of being the torturer extraordinaire amongst the group. He was kind of a very charismatic, almost wild man who operated within the ESMA, who many victims in the case have personally identified as torturing them. In the 1980s, as the military left power and the democracy was returning, Acosta was indicted, but used the opportunity to very forcefully vindicate the repressive campaign of the dictatorship. It was part of a time in Argentina when nobody quite knew if the democracy would survive, if there would be a military coup, and many of the highest military officials were publicly vindicating this campaign, hoping that it might save the image of the armed forces. Now, over the years, as it's grown clear that the armed forces does not have the power to overthrow the democratic government anymore, Acosta has grown increasingly silent. But he is, along with Astiz, probably the most well-known of the 19 defendants in this case.
And Sam, one of the things that you cover in this article that I was previously unaware of, and I've never been an expert on the dark era there in Argentina, but that there were children who were kidnapped. And there was actually some sort of a maternity ward or a like a daycare center at the torture center called the ESMA.
Yeah, the majority of victims of Argentina's dirty war, of the repressive reign of state terror during the 1970s, were basically young youths. I mean, every country, one professor told me, had its generation of 68. And here in Argentina, the response to that radical generation of 68 was essentially to exterminate them. But this means that many of the women who were kidnapped in this campaign might have been a few months pregnant. They might have had young children. And after the military disappeared, the mother or both the parents, they often took the kids and placed them into other military families. They forged their birth certificates. They forged their identity. And there are several hundred children, it's estimated, that grew up in military families. Sometimes, perhaps, that their parents were the ones who had actually killed their biological parents and have had their identity hidden from them throughout the years. Now, there's one human rights group here which is devoted exclusively to finding these missing children, called the Abuelas de la Plaza de Mayo, which means the grandmothers of the Plaza de Mayo. And so far, they've positively identified 99 children, but they suspect that there could be 400 other children out there who do not know their biological heritage.
That's pretty twisted, and I'm keeping my language clean, but that really is offensive, is just to listen to it. And Sam, talk a little bit about the issues being raised by the defense. One of them is that because those who are being held at the ESMA and subjected to torture were generally hooded, which has become a common practice now in the American detention of individuals, particularly when they're being moved, that the victims don't have eyewitness identification of those who tortured them. Plus, those who worked at the ESMA used assumed names, so it makes it more difficult to find people named Tigra or the Blonde Angel, or at least to specifically identify them in a legal sense because of the steps that they took to obscure their own identities.
Yeah, I mean, it was this horrendous campaign. As you said, most of the victims were hooded for the majority of the time they were kept there. They were kept silent. They were isolated from one another, so they couldn't speak to one another or to their captors. So the problem is it's very hard for a lot of these people to recognize who their captors were. Now, in another twisted part of this story, Tigre Acosta helped form what was known as the staff. He took some of these prisoners, many of whom were politically active, and in a quote-unquote process of recuperation, used them essentially as slave labor to translate foreign press stories that were coming out about the Argentine dictatorship, to help him write speeches, to do a whole host of activities to help foster the good image of the dictatorship, which was holding them secretly and using them as slaves. Now, many of these people were given more access, were given more freedom within the ESMA, and are the key witnesses in the case who have identified some of these people. But that said, they don't know everybody who was in the ESMA. Some of the charges have been brought against the torturers, and it's kind of a he said, she said. So the defense is hoping to rely on the fact that after 20 years, how can it be that these people can recognize by name and face their defendants? And the defense is hoping to say that some of the defendants can't get a fair trial because they've been so well recognized publicly as the torturers that people might be misremembering who tortured them and putting the blame on these defendants because they're the faces that they've seen in public.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's a logical defense on the part of the attorneys. It seems pretty amoral, but it's hard to try to put a moral frame around something that has been so out of bounds all along. Sam, what's the current status of these trials, and what do you see developing over the next few weeks and into the new year?
Yeah, so there's several cases going on right now in Argentina. There was just a report released by the public ministry saying that there have been 70% more human rights cases this year than last year, and there are a number set for the docket for the beginning of next year. So this, the pace of the cases has sped up. They've been kind of in pre-trial delay since 2003. So we should see more of these cases in the next year. But that said, the majority of the people implicated in these crimes are still languishing in the pre-trial phases, and it's a very slow justice system here, and it's possible that this is going to have a natural end and that the defendants might simply die before they can be sentenced and convicted.
Sam Ferguson, thank you for updating your reports, and people can look for earlier podcasts that Sam has contributed to here at the Peter B. Collins Show, and you can read his reportage at truthout.org. The articles we've been discussing were published December 11 and December 15th, 2009. Sam, Happy New Year to you, and we'll talk to you in 2010.
Happy New Year. Thanks, Peter.
And thanks for listening to this episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. Give me your feedback, Peter, at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.